I'm Caroline.
I'm Megan.
And I'm Shannon.
Welcome to Charm City Chief Chat, the podcast designed to support pediatric residents in Maryland's own Charm City.
Whether you're a seasoned senior or an intern navigating your first time on rounds, we're here to provide practical tips, expert insights, and real-world advice to help you thrive.
From the heart of Baltimore, let's tackle the challenges and joys of pediatric residency, one episode at a time.
Welcome to Charm City Chief Chat.
Welcome back to another episode of Charm City Chief Chat. Today, we're discussing vasculitis and multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. To help walk us through it is Dr. Priya Nigam. Dr. Nigam is a pediatric cardiologist who specializes in non-invasive cardiac imaging and fetal cardiology. She completed her pediatric residency at University of Maryland and then went on to complete a pediatric cardiology fellowship, as well as an additional fellowship in advanced non-invasive cardiac imaging. After completing her training, she returned to the University of Maryland as faculty. She is dedicated to serving and supporting her patients and their families, starting from the prenatal period and continuing through infancy, childhood, and young adulthood. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Let's start with Kawasaki disease. Can you help us understand what key clinical signs and history we should be on the lookout for when diagnosing KD in pediatric patients?
Yes. So we'll jump right in. So typically, Kawasaki presents with fever for at least 5 days, plus at least 4 out of 5 of what we call the principal clinical features. And so those principal clinical features include mucosal changes like erythema and cracking of the lips or strawberry tongue, conjunctivitis, macular papular rash, erythema and edema of the hands and feet, or desquamation, and that really depends on whether the patient is in the acute phase or a subacute phase, and then cervical lymphadenopathy, which is usually unilateral. And so it's important to get a complete history for these patients because some of these clinical features might have been present actually before the patient even presents for evaluation. And then there are some lab criteria that we use as well, which can be helpful to make that diagnosis. So there could be leukocytosis with neutrophil predominance, elevated inflammatory markers like CRP and ESR, hyponatremia, elevated liver enzymes, sterile pyuria, and thrombocytosis. And then there is something that we call atypical Kawasaki or incomplete Kawasaki. And that's when patients lack the full clinical features, but there's still a suspicion. And so this should be considered if patients have prolonged fevers, but they may not meet all of the clinical criteria that we just talked about, but they may have compatible lab data or even echo findings. And so that should be something that's considered as well.
Now, let's switch gears to MISE. I know when I was an intern, it was all over the news after COVID-19 pandemic. What are the clinical signs and key pieces of histories we should be looking for when considering the MISC diagnosis in our patients?
Yeah, so multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children. So this can oftentimes present very similarly to Kawasaki. So these kids will have fever and rash and mucosal changes and conjunctivitis. However, they will have GI symptoms. It's very common for these kids to present with GI symptoms. So abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, it's very common with MISE. And they can have myocarditis and neurologic symptoms like headaches and lethargy and confusion, as well as respiratory symptoms, respiratory insufficiency. And so these you don't typically see with Kawasaki. And then MISE can also, importantly, present with very varying severity. So on the severe end of the spectrum, these kids can actually present in cardiogenic shock. They can have myocardial dysfunction. They have elevated troponin and BNP levels, which can put them obviously in that very sick category. And so again, obtaining a history and labs can also be helpful for this patient population because these kids will either have a recent history of COVID themselves or have a COVID exposure. And then they'll also have the inflammatory markers that are elevated, hyponatremia, lymphopenia, and then thrombocytopenia.
Can you give us a few key differences between Kawasaki's disease and MISE?
Yep. So MISE commonly will affect older children and teenagers, whereas classic Kawasaki actually affects infants and younger children, like age 5 and younger. And then we talked about the differences in symptomology. So MISE commonly will have GI symptoms associated with it, whereas you don't see that quite as often with Kawasaki. And the myocardial dysfunction and even potentially cardiogenic shock You don't really see that with Kawasaki, but you can definitely see it with MISC. And then sometimes the laboratory markers can help differentiate as well. So inflammatory markers like CRP, ferritin, D-dimer, these are going to be really elevated in kids with MISC, whereas the absolute lymphocyte count and the platelet counts will be lower as compared to kids with Kawasaki. And then finally, we always think about coronary aneurysms in both of these pathologies, but it's actually less frequently seen in kids with MISC, and they resolve more quickly, even if they're present at all, in kids with MISC. Whereas in kids with Kawasaki, if they're kind of left untreated for longer than 10 days, they have a higher risk of having coronary involvement.
This leads me to another question for you, but I've had a few patients, even now as a chief, like attending on the floor, where mm-hmm. we're like, you know, MISC versus sepsis, almost like you have to rule out sepsis. And then it turned out to be sepsis. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder is there a way that we can come to that conclusion quicker than waiting for a blood culture? Or have you seen any differences in clinical, you know, presentation or lab values with those two things?
Yeah. So that's a great point, because they overlap. And you often have to treat kind of prophylactically for sepsis. And then once you've rule that out or rule that in, then you continue your antibiotic treatment. So when kids present in shock and they have MISC and you're not sure yet which one it is, we will start antibiotics on those kids and wait for the blood cultures to come back, wait for COVID testing to come back, or you're looking for, you know, like COVID antibodies to help make that differentiation. So oftentimes you're treating for both almost. You're going to start fluid resuscitation gently. You're going to start your antibiotic management, and then you're going to kind of wait for your labs to come back. So really looking for COVID exposure, looking for cultures to come back to help make that differentiation.
Now that we have COVID-19 vaccination, what has MISC changed at all, or has the presentation of it changed at all? We're probably seeing less of it, I'd say, but in your clinical opinion, kind of what has vaccination status done for our presentation and treatment of these patients?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right what you said about the frequency of MISC. I don't think we're seeing it as commonly as we used to before vaccination. And I think that helps because you're not seeing COVID cases as much. If kids are getting COVID, they're kind of responding to it or getting through it much better. And so the aftermath of that is that we're seeing less MISC in the hospitals as well.
So KD and MISC kind of present similarly, but you kind of talked about those GI symptoms and some of the lab work that will help differentiate. Now that we have that better understanding, how can we approach that initial management of both Kawasaki disease and MISC?
So for initial management, when you're looking at both classical Kawasaki and MISC, initial management is fairly similar. So they both will receive IVIG and some form of anticoagulation. And they both end up getting echocardiograms early on. But in Kawasaki, we'll typically start with high-dose aspirin and then kind of transition to low-dose aspirin once the patients become afebrile. With MISC, we also start steroids early on and then typically low-dose aspirin. But in those kids, if they have severe cardiac dysfunction or just based on their overall clinical picture, we may do low molecular weight heparin instead or do heparin in addition to aspirin because there's a higher risk of hypercoagulability in kids with COVID-19.
Now that we've covered the acute management, what would be the long-term sequelae that we should be concerned about with each, so Kawasaki disease and MISC?
So for patients with Kawasaki disease, if they don't have coronary involvement, then these kids actually do really well. But if they do have coronary involvement, then they may require continued anticoagulation and continued cardiology follow-up. And then we also monitor for the potential for coronary thrombosis, but that's actually a very rare complication. Now, in kids with MISC, again, if they never had cardiac dysfunction or coronary involvement, then they also do very well. And some of those kids you never even see because they were just managed in the outpatient world and the family may or may not even have known that they had MISC. But in patients, you know, who have had cardiac function changes or coronary involvement. These kids actually have to be exercise restricted for at least 3 to 6 months until their cardiac function returns to normal. Rarely, but it's been reported that sometimes these patients will also have some residual muscle weakness. They may have a reduced exercise capacity. And depending on how sick they were, like if they were in the PICU and required intubation, they may even have residual anxiety or emotional difficulties. But it is good that at least in the pediatric world, most kids do make a full recovery.
So when we're talking to patients before discharge, especially with MISC, like what should we be telling them the cardiology follow-up looks like maybe for a low-risk case versus they were sicker? Like how many echocardiograms do you do and how often do you see them?
That depends completely on their clinical course. So if they did fairly well, didn't have much coronary involvement, maybe had no cardiac dysfunction or just mild cardiac dysfunction, we'll definitely see all the patients 1 to 2 weeks afterwards. But then really it depends, the frequency in which we see them back and do their repeat echocardiograms depends on their clinical course. So if they were very sick, they were in the ICU, they had severe cardiac dysfunction, then that is a patient that we're going to follow more closely, maybe every 2 to 4 weeks early on, and then kind of space them out depending on how quickly they recover. But they are certainly going to be exercise restricted. Those kids will probably end up getting a cardiac MRI. We'll probably stress test them before we kind of release them back into the world. And the other important part of this is that some kids are just more prone to arrhythmias, tachyarrhythmias, or even like having an increased PVC burden. And so if that's something new for that patient, they may need repeat Holter monitors or event monitors. And so then they are also followed more closely.
So for our patients that we end up putting on low-dose aspirin prior to discharge, how long will they be on aspirin or low molecular weight heparin or these medications that they are going to require follow-up for?
So for patients who who had Kawasaki, if they were well and didn't have any coronary involvement, just a straightforward course, then those kids typically will be on aspirin for 4 to 6 weeks after, and then we'll clear them from cardiology care at that point, and then they don't really need to come back to see us or resume aspirin. There are specific clinical criteria that we follow for Kawasaki if they did have coronary involvement or other changes in their echocardiogram. And that can vary based on months to even years for the duration of anticoagulation. Now, for MISC, it's kind of similar in that it really depends on their clinical course. And so, you know, usually it might be just a few weeks after if they were very well. But again, in those sicker patients, it could be months to even years.
Awesome. So we talked a lot about sequelae of all of these, well, all of two of these things, Kawasaki and MISC. So follow-up is super crucial. And I really like that we talked about the long-term approach because it helps us with our patients when we're giving them, you know, anticipatory guidance for their discharge. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem.
It's been awesome to walk us through Kawasaki and MISC. I think our residents will get a lot out of this episode because these are things that we talk a lot about in medical school, but you definitely see them a lot in pediatric residency. And it's something that you see from day one on the floor as an intern. So this is great. We are better clinicians with this understanding and approaching the clinical diagnosis, management, and follow-up of these patients. So thank you so much. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Charm City Chief Chat, the podcast designed with pediatric residents in mind.
If you found today's episode helpful, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. You can reach out to us with podcast episode ideas at umdpedschiefs@som.umaryland.edu.
Please remember that all opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and not necessarily shared by our employer.